Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lin and Susan Shand. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lin.
Indian officials have banned half of all private vehicles from operating in the capital, New Delhi, because of poor air quality. An order announced Monday creates a system based on vehicle license numbers to restrict personal car use on New Delhi's roads. Vehicles with odd number license plates are permitted to operate only on odd number dates, such as 5, 7, and 9. Those with even numbers can be driven in the city only on even dates, such as 6, 8, and 10. Officials estimate the new rule will keep about 1.2 million registered vehicles off the roads each day. More than 600 police teams were deployed around the capital with the power to hand out $60 fines to drivers failing to obey the law. Officials said the measure will remain in place until at least November 15th. The ban does not affect New Delhi's 7 million motorcycles and scooters or public transportation vehicles. The restrictions were ordered as the city government declared a public health emergency because of pollution levels. India's Central Pollution Control Board said on Sunday the average air quality index, or AQI, for New Delhi was at 494, the highest level since November 2016, when it reached 497. The AQI is considered good when the number is below 50, and satisfactory when it stays under 100. AQI levels between 301 and 500 are considered hazardous for all population groups. Air pollution levels across northern India reach their highest level before winter as farmers set fire to clear their fields after the harvest. In New Delhi, air quality is also affected by Diwali. The Hindu religious holiday is celebrated around this time of year and includes the widespread lighting of fireworks. Information released by the World Health Organization last year showed that India had the world's 10 most polluted cities. Delhi's chief minister, Arvind Kejriwal, spoke about the latest air quality in a video published on Twitter. "There is smoke everywhere, and people, including youngsters, kids, elderly, are finding it difficult to breathe," he said. "Eyes are burning. Pollution is that bad." The Indian government has blamed more than half the capital's air pollution on emissions from vehicles and industry operations. In other measures, officials ordered a temporary ban on work at building projects and schools were closed until Wednesday. India's Supreme Court called Monday for state governments to take steps to reduce worsening air quality that it said could not be allowed in a civilized country. The court added, "This can't go on. People aren't safe. even inside their houses and rooms. I'm Brian Lynn.
The American fast food business, McDonald's, is known around the world and was in the news last weekend. McDonald's Corporation announced that its chief executive officer, CEO, has been forced out of the company for having a consensual relationship with an employee. The relationship was a violation of company policy, McDonald's said. And it accused CEO Steve Easterbrook, who also served as the company's president, of showing bad judgment. McDonald's bars supervisors from having romantic relationships with employees who directly or indirectly report to them. In an email to employees, Easterbrook admitted he had a relationship with an employee and that it was a mistake. Given the values of the company, I agree that it is time for me to move on, Easterbrook said in the email. McDonald's board of directors voted on Easterbrook's employment Friday after an investigation into his relationship. He will also be leaving the company's board of directors. Easterbrook was appointed as CEO in 2015. McDonald's would not provide details about the employee with whom Easterbrook had a relationship. A lawyer for Easterbrook would not answer questions. The board of directors named Chris Kempczinski as its new CEO and president. He recently served as president of McDonald's USA. 2 weeks ago, McDonald's reported a 2% drop in profits for the three-month reporting period ending on September 30th. 2019. During that period, the company said it spent a lot of money remodeling its stores and expanding delivery service. McDonald's also has reported that fewer people are going to its restaurants. The leadership change is unrelated to McDonald's operational or financial performance, the company said in a press release. McDonald's decision to remove its CEO may show there has been progress on workplace issues as a result of the Me Too movement, said Carl Tobias. He teaches law at the University of Richmond. Other companies don't always act on that kind of information, and so it seems like they are trying to enforce a strong policy in this situation, Tobias said. Last year, Brian Krzanich left his job as CEO of Intel Corporation after investigators found he had a consensual relationship with an employee that violated company policy. In December, CBS Corporation removed its CEO, Les Moonves, after several women accused him of sexual harassment. The CBS Board of Directors denied him $120 million promised under his contract with the company. Among other problems, McDonald's has faced workplace harassment charges. In May, the company said it was expanding anti-harassment training and offering a telephone hotline for workers to report problems. McDonald's made the changes after a labor group announced more than 20 sexual harassment cases against the company. Fight for $15 is the name of the group that brought the sexual harassment charges. It said McDonald's answers to the charges were not good enough. The company needs to be completely open about Easterbrook, the group said. Kempczinski joined McDonald's in 2015. He was responsible for nearly 14,000 McDonald's in the United States. I'm Susan Shand.
Researchers in Australia say evidence is weak as to whether medicinal cannabis treatments can help with mental illnesses such as anxiety, depression, and psychosis. They add that doctors should be very careful when deciding to give the treatments to patients. The researchers examined scientific studies on the effects of medicinal cannabinoids on 6 mental health disorders. They found a lack of evidence for their effectiveness. Louisa Degenhart is a drug and alcohol expert at Australia's University of New South Wales in Sydney. She said, her team's findings have important effects for countries such as the United States, Australia, Britain, and Canada. In those countries, doctors are making medical cannabis available for patients with some kinds of illnesses. The study results appeared in the publication The Lancet Psychiatry. Some military veterans and others who suffer post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, and anxiety say cannabis is helpful in easing some of their symptoms. Degenhart told Reuters, cannabinoids are often advocated as a treatment for various mental health conditions. But clinicians and consumers need to be aware of the low quality and quantity of evidence. Cannabis is also used for conditions such as nausea, epilepsy, and traumatic brain injury. The study did not examine its effects on those conditions. Degenhart's team wanted to look at all available evidence for all types of medicinal cannabinoids. They investigated whether the substances stopped or lessened symptoms of depression, anxiety, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, Tourette syndrome, PTSD, and psychosis. They examined 83 published and unpublished studies. The research covered about 3,000 people involved in studies between 1980 and 2018. They found that medicinal cannabis made psychosis worse, and it did not greatly affect any other major results for the mental illnesses studied. Tom Freeman is an addiction and mental health expert at Britain's Bath University. he was not involved with the study. But he said the findings show an important need for high-quality tests of medical cannabis to strengthen the evidence.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember in Washington. We have been talking about the Compromise of 1850. In September of that year, the United States Congress passed five bills that sought to settle the issue of slavery. All five became law after the president signed them.
Yes, I love everybody. No evil have I done.
Owning another human being was legal in many parts of the U.S. at that time. Most American slaves or their ancestors originally came from Africa. Many slaves worked for white landowners in cotton or tobacco fields. Some, like Phoebe Boyd of Virginia, worked in the family's home.
Had to clean up and set the table, put in the evening.
That recording comes from the Voices from the Days of Slavery project at the U.S. Library of Congress. Ms. Boyd was speaking in 1935, remembering her childhood as a slave. She said she had to clean up, set the table, carry the food, and afterwards prepare the bed. Harriet Smith of Texas was another former slave. She said in a 1941 recording that she did not go to school.
They know nothing about reading and writing. All that I know, the teachers of mine, your master and your missus.
Aunt Harriet, as she was called, said she did not know anything about reading or writing. She said she was taught only to obey the slave owners. Slaves were considered property, like farm animals or furniture. Slave owners could do anything they wanted with their slaves, including separate them from their families, sexually abuse them, hurt, or even kill them. Harriet Smith said her owners treated her well, but she heard about slaves who were mistreated.
Yes, I know times of mistreated people that did, I hear our folks talking about them hooping, that they had to grease the back to take the clothes from the back.
Some slaves were beaten so badly, she said, they had to repair the holes in their backs with grease. By 1804, all northern states had banned slavery. But northern whites still did not accept blacks as their equals. And slavery was still legal in southern states for more than half of the 19th century. Slave owners there said they needed slaves to work on large farms or for other economic reasons. But other Americans said slavery was immoral, or that it gave the South the unfair competitive edge of low-cost labor. The Compromise of 1850 attempted to balance the desires of those who supported and those who opposed slavery. Politicians were not the only ones who struggled with the issue of slavery in the United States. Slaves, for example, had been fighting the system for some time. Many slaves resisted their owners in small ways. They broke or hid tools, or they worked slowly or claimed to be sick even when they were not. A few answered the violence of slavery with violence. They planned, but rarely succeeded, to kill their masters and escape. A man named Nat Turner led one of the best-known slave rebellions. Turner was born in 1800 in the slave state of Virginia. Unlike most slaves, he could read. He also believed that God had given him a special purpose. In 1831, Turner saw what he described as a sign from above. The sign told him it was time to rebel against slavery. He gathered several men and in the middle of the night killed his master and his master's family in their beds. Turner and his men continued to another house and then another. They killed every white person they found. Other slaves saw what was happening and joined Turner. By the end of the raids, 40 blacks had stabbed, beaten, or shot to death an estimated 55 whites. A local white militia moved to stop Turner and his group. Almost all the attackers were captured quickly. Some were killed, others were sold and sent away from their families. But Nat Turner escaped capture. For a month, he hid around his master's farm. Finally, someone found him. Turner was jailed, tried, sentenced, and hanged. After he died, his killers pulled off his skin and removed his head. The historian Henry Louis Gates, Jr. studied Nat Turner's slave rebellion. He wrote that blacks remembered Turner for his personal war against slavery, his violent methods, and his harsh treatment after death. But whites had a different reaction. Frightened white mobs killed another 200 blacks to answer the rebellion. Most of these blacks had no part in the rebellion. After Nat Turner's rebellion, the state of Virginia passed stronger laws to control slaves. The legislation included bans on reading, gathering, and traveling. Even with stronger laws in place, many slaves continued taking huge risks in an effort to win their freedom. From about the end of the 1700s to the middle of the 1800s, thousands escaped slavery on what came to be called the Underground Railroad.
When the sun comes back and the first quail calls.
The Underground Railroad was not a real railroad. It was a group of people, both blacks and whites, who secretly helped slaves escape to the north.
Follow the drink and gold.
Members of the Underground Railroad helped slaves leave the places where they lived and worked. These conductors took the escaping slaves to a safe house or business called a station. Station masters hid the escaped slave. Then, at night, a different conductor took him or her to another hiding place farther north. The process was repeated every day and night until the escaped slave was safe in a free state or even in Canada. A black woman named Harriet Tubman was perhaps the most famous conductor on the Underground Railroad. She had been born a slave around 1820. She worked first in a house and then in the fields for an owner in the slave state of Maryland. Harriet Tubman was known for her bravery. One story people told about her happened when she was a teenage girl. An overseer, someone who controlled the slaves in the field, became angry with another slave. He threatened the man with a heavy weight. Young Harriet stepped between the overseer and the other slave. The overseer threw the weight. It hit her in the head. For the rest of her life, Harriet Tubman suffered from the injury. It caused headaches, strange dreams, and, from time to time, made her fall deeply asleep. When Tubman was about 29, she suspected her owner would sell her, so she decided to escape instead. One night, she secretly walked away. She walked over 200 kilometers following the North Star. Eventually, she arrived in the city of Philadelphia in the free state of Pennsylvania. A year later, Tubman returned to Maryland. She helped her sister and her sister's children escape. Then she helped her brother and two other men. She helped her parents, who were over 70 years old, and she helped many others. In all, Tubman made as many as 19 trips to the South. She led about 300 slaves to freedom. Tubman and her passengers were never caught, but if they had been, they would have been severely punished. Former masters were likely to beat or cut off the hands of escaped slaves. The Compromise of 1850 made escaping slavery even harder. One of the bills Congress passed was the Fugitive Slave Act. It said anyone who helped a fugitive, that is, an escaped slave, would be fined. And it said fugitive slaves must be returned to their owner, even if they had escaped to a free state. Fugitive slaves had no right to a trial. Because they could not defend themselves in court, even freed blacks could be kidnapped and enslaved. In 1852, a white woman published a book about slavery. She called it Uncle Tom's Cabin. Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote the book for one reason. She wanted to show how cruel slavery was. Fugitive slaves also published books about their experiences. The stories painted a picture of slavery that most people in the North had never seen. They were shocked. Public pressure to end slavery grew stronger. Anti-slavery activists, called abolitionists, wanted to free all slaves immediately. But even if that could be done, there was the question of what to do with the freed slaves. In many places, it seemed impossible that blacks and whites could live together peacefully and in freedom. The best answer, some people thought, was to free the slaves and help them return to Africa. It was not a new idea. In the early 1800s, a group of leading Americans had formed an organization for that purpose. They called it the American Colonization Society. In 1820, the society began helping to send blacks to Africa.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.